Okay, this is case number 72039, Renown Health et al. Versus Holland & Hart LLP and Robert Anderson. We have Ms. Leonard representing the appellants, Mr. McConnell representing the respondents. Before we proceed, a couple of housekeeping issues. Both Justices Pickering and Hardis were recused from participating in this case, so they will not be involved in the decision. Also, I would like to, before we go further into the argument, I'd like to turn it over to Justice Kadish, who would like to make a statement on it.
So, before I became a district judge in 2007, I practiced with the Hale Lane Law Firm from 1995 until 2007, and I became a shareholder there in 2000. After I left Hale Lane is when it merged with Holland & Hart, but I was never an employee or any part of the Holland & Hart firm. But while I was with Hale Lane, respondent Robert Anderson was my colleague and my partner, although we didn't work closely together because we were in different practice groups. While I was with Hale Lane, I also at various points had Andrew Pearl and Kelly Testelin, who testified for the appellants in this case. They were also colleagues of mine at the firm for some periods of time as well. Again, all of that happening before 2007. The events giving rise to this case occurred long after I had left the firm. So I don't have any existing business relationships with any of the parties. I don't have any bias or prejudice regarding any of the parties. So after reviewing it, I've concluded that I do not need to recuse myself. I did think it was appropriate to make this disclosure regarding my prior relationships with those folks. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Thank you, Justice Cage. Also, as you can see from the video, Monitor Justice Silver is participating from Las Vegas. Unfortunately, she wasn't able to come up here last night because of the snow and ice and all that, so we did set up video for arguments today. So Justice Silver could participate, and Justice Pickering will be participating on other cases by video today as well. Okay, with all that background, I think we can get started, and I'll go ahead, Ms. Leonard, you may proceed. You, by the way, may sit up there at the podium if you would like, and would you like to reserve any time in rebuttal?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Yes, thank you. Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, my name is Debbie Leonard on behalf of the appellants. Renown has identified two legal errors that prejudiced Renown's rights to have an unbiased jury consider its claims. One is the directed verdict on Renown's claims for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. The other is the district court's failure to afford Renown the protections guaranteed by NRS 49.405 by denying motion number one. The district court allowed Holland & Hart to probe privileged information, prompt privileged objections, and comment to the jury on Renown's proper information of privilege. Notwithstanding that from start to finish, the district court found that Renown had not waived the attorney-client privilege. These errors were prejudicial and tainted the entire trial, and for that reason, I want to start by first turning to the erroneous ruling on motion in limine number one. And to frame the issue for the court, I think the court must appreciate that this case involved disputes about privilege from start to finish. Renown's position from the outset was that it would not rely on privileged communications to prove its claim. Nevertheless, Holland & Hart brought multiple motions to compel privileged information, arguing that Renown had put privileged information at issue and contending that under Wardley there had been an at-issue waiver. And the district court repeatedly denied those motions to compel, stating that Renown had not waived the attorney-client privilege. So consistent with those rulings and pursuant to NRS 49.405, Renown, prior to trial, brought motion in limine number one, and it sought to prevent Holland & Hart from prompting a privilege objection, eliciting testimony regarding the invocation of the privilege, or commenting on Renown's invocation of the privilege. And this is exactly what NRS 0.405 says. Subsection 1 says there should be no comment on the invocation of the privilege. subsection 2 says, in jury cases, proceedings shall be conducted to the extent practicable so as to facilitate the making of claims of privilege outside the presence of the jury. Notwithstanding that this was squarely within the prohibition of the statute, the district court denied motion in limine number 1. And the rationale or the ground stated by the district court was this. I think it is appropriate if, for example, a witness is going to answer a question and part of that answer is something that can't be given because of the attorney-client privilege, I think it's appropriate that the defense know that. Now, that was unsound rationale for two reasons. First, trial is not an information-gathering exercise. Discovery is. And in fact, during discovery, Holland and Hart had already gained that information. It spent discovery pushing the contours of the privilege, exploring as far as it could into privileged communications. Second, even if trial could be used for an information gathering purpose, there's nothing that precluded the district court from having that information be gathered outside the presence of the jury. The district court, in its rationale, only said the defense was entitled to know information. It said nothing about the jury needing to know this information.
So don't you think that the motion limiting number 1, I mean, it's pretty broad. You know, nobody gave the district court, out of fairness, a deposition, transcripts, anything to say keep this out. It was just like keep all privileged information out. And it's very hard for a district court judge to figure out what's in and what's out based on this broad language that was used. Later in your reply, you were able to concentrate, I guess, better on certain testimonies, but it does appear that motion limiting number 1 was very, very broad. So the district court denied it without prejudice. How is that reversible error?
Well, Your Honor, I have a few responses to that. The first is the district court didn't even analyze the statutory language and did not even evaluate whether it was practicable to allow Holland Hart to obtain this information outside the jury's presence. There was no attempt whatsoever to comply with the statute. The second response I have to that is that the district court repeatedly found that there had been no waiver of attorney-client privilege. If that's the case, then there should be no exploration into privileged communications. And again, if you go back and look at the rationale that the district court provided, it wasn't that Holland Hart was entitled to know the communications. It was saying that Holland Hart was entitled to know when part of an answer wasn't being given because there was some attorney-client communication. Again, the district court had an independent obligation to look at the statutory language and determine what was practicable and what wasn't, and the district court did not engage in that analysis. And it turned out, and it was demonstrated towards the end of trial, that it was entirely practicable to conduct offers of proof, let the Holland and Hart do those if it wished to, and there was no reason to have done that in the presence of the jury.
There wasn't an offer.
I'm just saying the first motion limine, the written motion limine. I'm sorry if I'm talking over. Sorry, there's a delay. But that you're going into trial. I'm talking about that first motion limine. Wouldn't you concede it was quite broad? How is a district court to formulate what's in and out just based on that motion limine?
Well,
I don't know. I mean, down in the Eighth Judicial, sometimes we don't even see. We may sign off on some discovery commissioner's reports, but I'm looking at that motion limine thinking that's very broad.
Again, I think, Your Honor, my response is you go back to the purpose for which this information was being sought, and there was no reason to do that in front of the jury.
How would you know to violate what's being violated? How does the district court even come up with an order? You could say, yes, okay, I'm going to follow the statute, granted, boom. But how does it change what happened here? How is that reversible error? And that's what you're saying. The district court should have granted that first motion in limine. That written motion limine.
Well, that is certainly
and you're
our
saying
position.
You later can.
It's certainly our position that should have been granted. It could have been granted in part, but there was no effort whatsoever to comply with it. And, you know, certainly you can peel down a little bit and look at, you know, Renown sought to not have the Hollenhardt comment on Renown's invocation of the privilege. That's squarely within the four corners of the statute. Yet the district court made no effort to ensure that that type of comment didn't occur and didn't grant the motion in limine, even in part, to say, wait, you can't do that. And so it allowed Hollenhardt to do exactly that, to comment on the privilege. That is squarely within the prohibition of the statute.
It would have been Renown's obligation then when it was like a without prejudice. So during the trial, then, wouldn't it be up to Renown to object if there was an inappropriate comment on the privilege?
Well, I think this court's case law is clear that the motion in limine itself was enough to preserve the objection, and that's the BMW case. But it's, and I think we've pointed it out and cited to it in our briefs, that Renown not only filed this motion in limine, but also repeatedly in the in off the record, or excuse me, outside the presence of the jury, repeated and said, you know, we're not going to re-argue the motion in limine because the court has ruled on that. And the court repeatedly returned to that ruling. But I think that between the motion in limine itself, there was a memorandum of law that was filed later in the case that reiterated the same arguments in the motion in limine. And there was discussion with the district court outside the presence of the jury as to how this was inappropriate. But I think this court's case law is sufficient to preserve that issue, that the motion in limine preserved that issue.
I mean, did the court hold, contrary to the statute, that in fact it's okay to comment on the invocation of the privilege?
Well, the court denied the request in the motion in limine to prevent Hollenhardt from commenting on the privilege. So I don't know if you call it a holding, but certainly the district court didn't grant the motion in limine in whole or in part. So turning to the outcome of what exactly happened, and we've cited to this in our briefs, that using knowledge that it gained during discovery, Hollenhardt engaged in a practice of asking questions that would prompt a privilege objection, and we've enumerated those in the brief. And the district court put Renown in this untenable position of having to object adequately enough to protect the privilege and to prevent a waiver, which is exactly what Hollenhardt wanted to keep, kept emphasizing was occurring, but also to sparingly enough to protect its credibility in front of the jury. So this is exactly what the statute is designed to protect against. And as we've noted in our briefs, counsel commented repeatedly about the cat being out of the bag and I'm entitled to know and the jury is entitled to know what happened at meetings and conversations that were absolutely privileged.
Ms. Leonard, with respect to the jury's entitled to know comment, how's that plain error? I mean, because there wasn't an objection, as I understand, to that comment. How do we view it through that lens in the absence of objection?
Well, I would go back to my response to Justice Kadish that the motion in limine number one said, requested that there be no comment on the invocation of the privilege. It was preserved, and the BMW case, I think, addresses that. So it's not the plain, we don't have to meet the plain error standard. I think it's adequately addressed in that motion in limine number one. And I think that I've addressed that none of these errors were harmless. I mean, these were, I think that they were prejudicial because at no point in trial did Renown get the protections of the statute. Every minute of that trial, Renown was on the defensive, having to anticipate questions with regard to the privilege, and that would prompt a privilege objection. And we've cited to the Hilton and George cases where just one instance of violating the statute was enough. I just want to turn briefly to the directed verdict issue, and I think that Hollenhardt does not dispute that the district court did not follow the right standard. The district court was required to view the evidence and all inferences in favor of Renown, and the district court didn't review any particular evidence and certainly didn't draw any inferences in favor of Renown. And Hollenhardt does not dispute that. And we've cited in our briefs to considerable evidence from which the jury could have reached a verdict in favor of Renown. I mean, Holland & Hart was retained to close a deal, didn't follow its own closing procedure, had the attorney, the doctor sign signature pages that were not affixed to any contract, but they never made sure everyone agreed to the material terms of the contract. And they even acknowledged that they didn't know. We have this email from Chris Ann Cunningham that says, have the doctors all seen Exhibit A, I'm assuming? Never got a response, never followed up. And they're retained to close a deal on which everybody agrees to the material
terms. What contract was the implied covenant implied in?
The contract, well, it was the implied contract between the...
So it's an implied covenant and an implied contract.
Well, I don't... Your Honor, I don't. There was no dispute that there was an implied contract. It was whether the jury didn't find a breach of the implied contract. But I don't think there was any dispute that there was an implied contract. So, again, we believe these errors were not harmless. You have a verdict that was based on the privilege problems. The breach of the implied covenant claims were separate and independent claims. They had separate elements that... the jury could have found that Anderson and Holland and Hart deliberately contravened the intention and spirit of the contract, that they engaged in arbitrary or unfair acts that worked to Renown's disadvantage, and that Renown's justified expectations were denied. That language was not found in any jury instruction.
Going back to the privilege issue, I just wanted to confirm. You had requested a jury instruction that no adverse inference should be that was allowed, and it became part of the final instructions, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Our contention is that was too little too late. I mean, the motion in limine said that none of this should have gone on, or sought that none of it go on. We requested an instruction on day 8, and counsel below repeatedly said, look, I'm not going to revisit and re-argue your ruling on the motion in limine. And I think every time that gets said, that's adequate to preserve the motion in limine objection. But then...
I was talking about in terms of prejudice.
Well, again, you have to go back and look, what is this statute designed to address? And it's exactly this issue. Renown got none of the protections afforded by it. And so when you wait until day 12 of a 14-day trial to give an instruction, the jury has already formed its opinions with regard to the parties. And if, again, we think it's too little too late.
Ms. Leonard, we asked you a lot of questions, so we'll give you 2 minutes of rebuttal. We'll add two minutes to Mr. McConnell's time to balance it out. Mr. McConnell.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike McConnell. I represent Holland & Hart and Bob Anderson. I'll respond to the privilege issue.
Can you talk in? I cannot hear you. You got to talk into the mic. It's really bad. Sorry.
Is that okay?
No. I still can't hear him. I'm having audio trouble. Can you guys hear him?
Yes.
Let me try again. Usually I'm not difficult to hear.
There you go.
If I can respond to the privilege issue first, the trial court, I submit, did not abuse its discretion about its decisions with respect to privilege. At the outset, it's important to understand that Renown's causation and damages, what a Renown's causation and damages theory was. Renown claimed that Holland & Hart somehow made the Arger case indefensible and forced Renown to settle it during the middle of the Arger trial. Holland and Hart had nothing to do with the Arger trial. That was their causation and damage theory. Renown chose that theory, not Holland and Hart. Holland and Hart was entitled to challenge and defend the $8 million damage and causation theory that Renown asserted against it. And Renown's causation and damage theory begged a number of obvious questions, such as, why did you settle? Given Renown's theories and claims against Holler and Hart, that was a perfectly appropriate question. That question was the subject of most of the argument about motion in limine number one. And Renown could never articulate a bright line that would, to the court or to us, that would permit us to somehow distinguish what Renown thought was okay and what Renown thought was not okay. Renown acknowledged that it was appropriate to ask the question, as it is, why did you settle? Privilege objections cannot be used to exclude non-privileged information. The Wardley decision does not permit a litigant to present privileged information it likes, but exclude privileged information, non-privileged information it doesn't like. The rules adopted in Wardley inform the trial court's exercise of discretion with respect to motion in limine number one and the privilege dispute in general. Wardley says that a party cannot seek an advantage in litigation by revealing part of a privileged communication. Wardley recognized that the selective use of privileged information can garble the truth. Under Wardley, there is no privilege to garble the truth. So the assertion of privilege cannot be used to furnish one side with what may be false evidence and deny the other side the means to be. Wardley says that when one side injects part of a communication as evidence, fairness demands the opposing party be allowed to examine the whole picture. Renown's motion in limine number one sought an order that both violated Wardley, those principles that I just outlined, and was not practicable. And the relief requested in motion in limine number one, the court could not come up with, and Renown's lawyers could not articulate a practical approach to establish a line between an appropriate question like, why did you settle, and what the type of question that Renown wanted us to ask.
We can't hear. Sorry.
Outside the presence of the jury, which is part of the goal of the statute, NRS 49.405. So I guess, was it error to not have implemented a procedure like that sooner rather than having all this discussion about privilege taking place in front of the jury where they might think, what is everybody trying to hide from me?
I would submit not. Justice, what you're referring to is the way the defense approached the testimony of Kirk Lenhardt, who was Renown's lead trial counsel in the Archer case. And in order to comply with the statute 49405, we proposed dividing Mr. Lenhardt's testimony into two blocks. We would ask questions in the presence of the jury, and if you look at the record, there is not a single privilege objection made during my examination of Mr. Lenhardt in the presence of the jury. Then, to preserve the record about privilege issues, we proposed a out of the presence of the jury in camera process, and there were lots of privilege objections to the questions then, and Renown is now asserting that the fact that it asserted a lot of privilege objections to the out of the presence of the jury module for Mr. Lenhardt somehow illustrates our improper approach to privilege. I would submit it's exactly the opposite. So we did follow that procedure with Mr. Lenhardt.
All right. So the question is, could something like that have been done with other witnesses, which would have potentially avoided some of what they're saying is prejudicial reference to the privilege in front of the jury.
Let me offer an illustration of why that was not practical across the board. In Renown's case in chief, they called Jim Miller their CEO. And he was a key witness in the Archer case. He was being cross-examined by Kent Robeson for 2 days, and in the middle of the trial recess on the second week on a Friday afternoon, in the middle of that cross-examination, the case settled over that weekend. Mr. Miller answered questions asked by Renown on direct examination about his preparation by the Brownstein lawyers. And Mr. Caldwell, Renown's lawyer in our case, asked him, isn't it a fact, Mr. Miller, that there were 10 preparation meetings with Brownstein lawyers to get you ready to testify? And Mr. Miller responded that there were 10 meetings, but they didn't prepare me during those meetings. So in response, I would submit that under Wardley, that there has Renown has offered testimony about a meeting that may or may not contain privileged information. I asked the question, what happened at those meetings? As I would submit, I was entitled to. Renown objected. I responded to the objection, and I'll come back to that in a minute. But the objection was sustained. So I would submit that type of dynamic did not lend itself to a pre-planned, out of the presence of the jury kind of presentation. If Renown wanted to do it that way, Renown could have. Renown never had to assert a privilege objection in the presence of the jury. Every time Renown asked for a sidebar, it was given, and I never objected. Every time Renown asked for chambers conference, I never objected, and that occurred. So Renown was in control of when it asserted privilege in front of the jury, not Holland and Hart. And I think that's a key misunderstanding about the whole privilege argument that Renown's making here, is that Renown controlled when it uttered the word privilege in the presence of the jury. There was not a single instance where the lawyers for Holland and Hart ever spontaneously spoke the word privilege in front of the jury. Not one. No mention in closing argument, no mention in comments or anything like that. So one of the points I want to make is a follow-up on the fact that the court gave 49-405 jury instructions twice. The jury is presumed to have followed those instructions. The jury, if the jury followed those instructions, then the alleged errors were harmless. On appeal, Renown has made no attempt to rebut that presumption. And if the court applies the presumption that the jury followed the 405 instructions, then I submit it should affirm on that ground alone. Second, the evidence that drew privilege objections related to causation and damages, not liability. The jury unanimously found Holland and Hart was not liable, was not negligent, did not breach an implied contract, and did not breach fiduciary duties. The jury never reached issues of causation and damages. Therefore, Renown cannot satisfy its burden of showing the probability of a different outcome if privilege had been handled differently. And this is a second way in which any alleged error relating to privilege was harmless. As I said, Renown was in control of how it, whether it said the word privilege or made any statements about privilege in the presence of the jury, not Holland and Hart. So I submit the doctrine of invited error applies.
With regard to the motion in limine itself being denied pretrial, so they try to address this issue pretrial and they get denied. Did you understand the district court to have ruled that you could comment on assertion of the privilege contrary to 49405?
No. And I didn't.
And so what does it mean that she denied the motion in limine asking for that to be precluded in accordance with the statute?
I think the record reflects her, Judge Robb's thinking, because there was a lot of discussion, hours of argument about it, and she didn't perceive there to be the proposed relief requested by the motion to be a practical approach to the complexity of that privilege presented given Renown's theory. With respect to comments about privilege, the remarks that Renown now complains about were made by me in response to Renown's objections. They weren't speaking objections by me. They were responses to, as I think I was required to do, responding to because I disagreed with the objection. Tried to succinctly make an argument in a few sentences in a shorthand fashion. And the points that the cat out of the bag remark and the jury's entitled to no remark were both references to testimony such as Mr. Miller's, where Renown had elicited testimony about the very meeting and so forth I was asking about. So this was not something like Hilton and George and Emerson, where a prosecutor's making argument in closing or gratuitous comments to the jury seeking to create some inference. That was not it at all. And they were isolated over the span of a three-week trial. There were three objections to questions that I asked that were sustained on the basis of privilege. Most of the objections that Renown asserted on the basis of privilege were to answers that its own witnesses were giving to non-objectionable questions. And I would submit that very dynamic illustrates the impracticability of motion in limine number one. So if I can quickly jump to the implied covenant points. There are several reasons why I submit the court should affirm the directed verdict. First, lawyers have a higher fiduciary duty to clients than the duty the implied covenant imposes on parties to commercial contracts. The trial court allowed Renown's fiduciary duty claim to go to the jury. The trial court instructed the jury on Holland & Hart's fiduciary duties as Renown requested. And that instruction said Holland & Hart owed Renown fiduciary duties of utmost loyalty and good faith. That's a quote. Also, a fiduciary duty to fully and fairly disclose all material facts to Renown and to exercise the skill and diligence of a prudent attorney. I submit that as a matter of law, a lawyer's higher fiduciary duties encompass whatever lower commercial duties arise from the implied covenant. It is logically and legally impossible to serve a client with utmost loyalty and good faith, which this jury unanimously found, but at the same time somehow be unfaithful to the client or the purpose of the representation. Simply put, the jury's unanimous finding that Holland & Hart acted with utmost good faith precludes the finding of bad faith. And given the jury's verdict, any alleged error is harmless. Second, this court has had no hesitation to rule implied covenants fail as a matter of law. The 2017 decision in the State Department of Transportation and the Nelson versus Herr decision are illustrations of that. So applying a legal analysis to a lawyer's higher fiduciary duties to whatever lower commercial duties may arise from an implied covenant, I would submit lead to similar conclusions. And the implied covenant claim fails as a matter of law. Third, Renown failed to present evidence during its case in chief establishing a prima facie implied covenant claim. During its case in chief, Renown did not call Mr. Testelin, who was the general counsel who hired Holland and Hart and had the contractual interactions with him. There was no Renown representative who had contractual interactions with Holland and Hart who testified. Who testified that they were Holland Hart was unfaithful to the purpose of the contract or deliberately contrary to it.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Leonard, you have 2 minutes. And...
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd just like to start with the implied covenant piece that my colleague just spoke to, because I'd like to draw the court's attention to the jury instructions that were provided by Renown but rejected by the district court on the implied covenant claim, and those are found at volume 6, pages 1405 to 1406. And you can look at the language in there, and it's distinct from any of the other jury instructions that were actually submitted to the jury. And that, and if you look at that language and compare it to what was submitted, I would say that this is not harmless error, that this jury, just because it came up with a defense verdict on the other claims, that it likewise was appropriate for the directed verdict to be entered and there was no harmless error. Turning back to the privilege issues, the district court did not have discretion to ignore the statute, and that is effectively what the district court did. There was no attempt at compliance. And I think it's important for the court to go back and look and think, what is the purpose of this statute? It is, the purpose is to prevent exactly what occurred here. And a ruling in favor of Holland and Hart here would basically say that none of these protections can be afforded to a litigant at all, no effort made, and yet there would be, that's not prejudicial error. And I just, when an entire trial is infected with privilege objections, comment, and I didn't hear much of an answer from counsel as to how it could possibly be appropriate to comment on the invocation of the privilege at any time, no matter what the in limine ruling was. There's simply, I don't think you can come to the conclusion that this was just harmless error. So we would request that the court vacate the judgment and remand for a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, both attorneys. Excellent arguments and briefs. We appreciate it very much. We will be in a very brief recess to reconstitute the court. So if the next parties to the State Engineer versus Happy Creek would like to come.